Chapter 45. British Demagoguery. Strangely enough, the ones who, even before the arrival of delegates to the peace conference in Paris, were the spokesmen for a policy of vengeance, were not the French, but the British establishment. More than any other country, Britain had taken great care to ensure that the war would prove profitable to its trade and imperialism. The British establishment would allow nothing to stand in the way of its greed for gain. In 1914, the British Empire owned a quarter of the world. To ensure Versailles would not upset its institutionalized policy of pillage and piracy, the British imperialists had, ahead of the event, stuck clever stickers on the spoils of the German and Turkish colonial empires. Of particular interest were the Middle East oil fields and German possessions in Africa. London needed Tanganyika, an African region of great strategic and economic importance for them, to link its northern colonies of Egypt and Sudan to its southern Africa lands, which they had fairly recently stolen from the Boers. Long before the armistice, the British had appropriated for themselves the German colonial empire as if by divine right. The British Empire now controlled 35,467,656 square kilometers of the Earth's surface, 10 times more than it did in the 18th century. It had also acquired what it had striven for 3 centuries, dominion of the seas. The British simply confiscated the entire German navy and merchant marine. All the German ships had been taken to England at the base of Scapa Flow and were to be distributed among the victors, who by Armistice Day included most of the world's countries. The distribution was typically British: 70% of the ships would go to Britain and the balance to the rest of the world. The war had also well served the British policy of divide and rule, by which Britain reserved the right to foment unrest and wars in Europe. It has always been an article of faith for the British establishment to stop any European country from becoming too strong commercially or otherwise. Germany had been a prime target of this policy because its ships threatened to compete with British cartels and monopolies. Germany was earmarked for destruction only because it was successful. It joined a long list of countries which at one time or another over the years found themselves embroiled in wars and conflict against nations backed by Britain. The British establishment had seen them as a threat, real or imagined, and had immediately set their agencies in motion to deal with the problem by fomenting wars. Britain had always regarded Europe as a patchwork of alien entities to be manipulated for the greater glory and wealth of the British establishment, and had never considered itself as part of Europe. "England is only bound to Europe, but it is not part of it," declared Churchill. British support for one country doing its bidding was never long-standing. As soon as it had served its purpose, it was abruptly discarded. Friendship or loyalty were never a consideration. Lord Palmerston clearly explained British policy: "Great Britain has no lasting friendship or enmity with anyone, it has only permanent interests." Even Clemenceau remarked: "Great Britain has never ceased to be an island defended by the sea. Because of this, it deems it necessary to multiply the causes of discord among the people of the continent to ensure the peace of its conquests." Considerable means were put at the disposal of this policy. Britain's European policy has mostly consisted in keeping the people of Europe in check, using some to check the others. On Armistice Day, Britain had once more reached its goal. It had eliminated its competitor by foul play. Spain in its heyday had suffered a similar fate. Spanish ships had opened up the New World, watched by a jaundiced British eye. Instead of exploring new worlds themselves, the British unleashed a fleet of pirates on the unsuspecting Spaniards. Pirates who stole the most gold, murdered the most Spaniards and sunk the most galleons were automatically knighted by Her Britannic Majesty and cut in on a percentage of the booty. For 200 years the British establishment lived off the proceeds of their piracy against Spain. Napoleonic France was also under constant British attack for its attempt to unify Europe. The British had favored Napoleon as a revolutionary tearing France apart, but when he became emperor he had to go. A strong France could not be tolerated. During the entire 19th century, Europe was kept in a constant state of turmoil and wars, of which the only beneficiary was British imperialism. November 11, 1918 marked the downfall of Germany, the 1914 trade competitor of Great Britain. The British were quite vocal in demanding reparations from a prostrate Germany, perhaps to deflect attention from the fact they had already helped themselves to the lion's share of German assets. Yet the British were not through with Germany. She was going to be used to fuel the mills of British politics. Lloyd George was facing elections, and he decided to ride the wave of enthusiasm created by the Allied victory over Germany. The British voters had for the last 4 years been subjected to an orgy of anti-German propaganda, and Lloyd George thought the war hysteria had been squeezed for all it was worth. He would appeal to the voters on the benefits his government had got out of the war. Britain had already destroyed Germany, and he saw no point and certainly no profits in kicking a dead horse. The British establishment was at that time eyeing France as the next competitor to be knocked down. The French had lost almost 2 million men during the war, and they were thirsting for vengeance and reparations. The war had been fought on their territory, and they felt entitled to the lion's share. Since the British lion had already taken care of that, Lloyd George felt the French would prove obnoxious upon waking up to find out there was nothing left to squeeze out of Germany. They might even turn against the British with the rage of a cheated partner. Furthermore, since the French government had firmly implanted in its subjects the notion that France was responsible for winning the war, the issue of vengeance and reparations became an emotionally charged national issue beyond the scrutiny of knowledge or reason. Churchill was instructed to meet with Lloyd George in order to develop some kind of bipartisan policy to deal with likely French expectations and recriminations. The establishment even contemplated helping Germany to recover enough to create a counterweight to the French. On April 11, Churchill dined with Lloyd George at 10 Downing Street. Churchill narrated the event. "We were along in the main hall under the gaze of Pitt, Fox, and Nelson. The greatness and magnitude of our victory produced in us a feeling of lightness and detachment. Yet our task was in no way terminated. My mind was shared between apprehension for the future and a desire to help a defeated enemy. We went on talking about the great qualities of the German people, of the terrible struggle they had to bear against three quarters of the world, of the impossibility of remaking Europe without German participation. We thought at the time they were actually dying of starvation. We thought famine and defeat would slide the Teutonic population into the deadly abyss that had already devoured Russia. I suggested we should, without waiting for any more news, send to Hamburg half a dozen ships filled with food. Although the armistice conditions were not to lift the blockade until peace had been signed, the Allies had promised to provide sufficient food, and the Prime Minister looked upon my proposition favorably. Outside, the songs and the hurrahs of the crowd were reaching our ears, like waves on the shore. But sentiments of a different nature would soon prevail." Churchill and Lloyd George waxed pompous on helping the hungry in the comfortable club atmosphere of Downing Street. These were noble thoughts which, however, were not meant for public consumption but rather to be dissipated in the fumes of after-dinner cigars. Outside, the world of electioneering and politicking had little time for high-mindedness. A week after the dinner, Lloyd George was won over to the idea of whipping up more anti-German hysteria as the best way to win the election. British master propagandists had demonstrated how effective their anti-German lies could be both at home and abroad. For a politician like Lloyd George, it was nothing to change issues or policy. In August 1914, he was a staunch opponent of the war. Then he changed his mind in exchange for a cabinet post. 3 years later, he had become Prime Minister of the pro-war party. Anti-Germanism was a proven recipe for winning elections, and Lloyd George fully intended to use it. With a certain black humor, Churchill commented, "The War of the Giants had ended, the bickering of pygmies has started." World Crisis, Volume 4, page 27. British propaganda had portrayed Kaiser Wilhelm II as an absolute monster who, alone, had wanted the war. The Kaiser bugbear, Hun horror tales about atrocities and dastardly sinkings of innocent civilian ships such as the Lusitania has been most profitable for British politicians. They were once more waved in the face of the crowds. The voters had been well conditioned for 4 years and responded enthusiastically by sweeping Lloyd George and his coalition government for another term. The British establishment thought it unwise to switch hate hysteria from the Germans to the French too abruptly. Although it had the utmost confidence in the voters' proverbial lack of memory, it realized the electorate had actually become addicted to anti-German hysteria. The crowd demanded that the Kaiser and his Huns, who had allegedly mutilated Belgian children and shot Red Cross nurses, and killed British subjects, should be hanged, and Hunland pay forever for their ghastliness. A police report at the time read, "The same sentiments dominate in all classes. The Germans must pay for the damages they have caused with their last cent, even if they have to pay for 1,000 years. Cabinet Minister Barnes was cheered by the crowds and he cried out routinely, "The Kaiser must hang." Lloyd George was equally vehement and promised, "The Emperor of Germany will be judged and eventually put to death." Churchill had long since jettisoned his temporary magnanimity and had joined the bloodthirsty pack in demanding that the Kaiser be put on trial and hanged. Even that did not satisfy the voters, who insisted that a punishment worse than death be guaranteed. Churchill noted, "Women displayed the most violence. All the classes and all the parties in the town of Dundee demanded the Kaiser's hanging. I was obliged to demand he be brought to justice." Hanging the Kaiser and bleeding Germany white might have made the British electorate delirious, but it did not make economic sense. The use of free German labor would only increase unemployment at home and would also deprive Germany of money to pay its enormous war debt. It was really a matter of trying to pluck a plucked chicken. After the elections, politicians soon forgot, privately at least, all their blood-curdling promises and went back to the business of money. Lloyd George commissioned British economist John Maynard Keynes, who came up with a maximum figure of £2 billion sterling for reparation. There was such an outcry the amount was deemed to be far too low that the commission's recommendations were quickly swept into the dustbin. Churchill still tried to convince his constituents of Dundee that the figure of £2 billion sterling was reasonable and sensible. He carefully addressed the voters. "The Germans must pay reparations, applause, they must pay large reparation, applause. In 1870 they demanded large reparations from France. We will make them pay 10 times more, long applause. £200 million, that is to say, 5 billion gold francs multiplied by 10, that makes £2 billion. Churchill had thought he had sold the voters, but soon realized no one had bought his argument. "The next day they started taking a close look at my figures. An arrogant telegram was sent to me from an important chamber of commerce, haven't you forgotten a zero? The local newspapers were stridently screaming 12 billion, 15 billion. These figures were flying off the lips of men and women who, only yesterday, were satisfied with 2 billion. Overwhelmed, Churchill beat a hasty retreat, "Well, naturally, if we can get more." Lloyd George knew the insanity of such demands, but he was not going to be outdone on the hustings, where he repeated the famous statement, "We will squeeze the German lemon until the pips squeak." He raised the figure to £24 billion sterling, 12 times more than he had been advised by economic experts Germany could possibly pay. "Yes," he proclaimed before a delirious crowd, "they will pay this to the last cent, even if we have to search their pockets." In 1918, German pockets were more likely to be filled with holes than cents. But the inflationary rhetoric had propelled Lloyd George and his coalition to a landslide victory with 83% of the seats in the House of Commons. His prime ministership was secured for several more years. Churchill made another political somersault, jumped on Lloyd George's bandwagon, and was Minister for War. The triumph of demagoguery in Britain ensured the failure of the Versailles Conference. No British minister was about to lower the figure. It was accepted dogma, not only believed by the English population, but also unanimously by the French. Lloyd George tried to shed his electoral promises the following month and on many later occasions, but always without success. He was stuck with them for better or worse.